Hey, heathens, the holidays are here, and we've partnered, as always, with Follow, the company that's helping you give gifts that actually matter. Follow directly supports wildlife preservation, and we share their mission to leave this planet a little brighter and wilder than we found it. So instead of another pair of socks or a candle this year, how about giving someone a bracelet that saves animals? When you buy from Follow, you'll get a stunning animal-themed bracelet, and you get to pick which specific animal to track. They've got lions, penguins, whales, red pandas, koalas, snow leopards, and so much more. Guys, they even have sloths, just like Lola's. Yes, her sloth is living her best life, and somehow, I don't know how she's doing it, but she's somehow still more active than me this winter. Okay, guys, if jewelry isn't your thing, though, don't worry, okay? Follow has the cutest plushies. Each purchase comes with an info card about your animal and a tracking code so you can follow their real-life adventures through the Follow app, no matter if you get a bracelet or a plushie, okay? It's the perfect holiday gift that gives back, and Follow is giving all of our listeners 20% off any purchase with code LACYBEAN20. So click the link in our show notes, use the code at checkout, and make this holiday season a little wilder. Again, the code is LACYBEAN20. Now, back to the show. Hey, heathens, you're listening to the Deadly Faith Podcast, where religion and crime collide. I'm Lacey.
I'm Lola.
And it is our 101 episode. Burr, 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 burr.
The mind that was in Jesus, that mind is in me.
Without me, life has no meaning.
Why would God tell you what I'm thinking and tell you what I've said to my wife or my husband when you're not around? It's because I'm the pastor of the church and I need to know.
This is the only place where you can see truth.
We are coming at you with part two. I'm surprised I sound that cheerful because literally we just got done recording part one and dear God, Jim Jones is a lot.
Well, you had some mashed potatoes in between, so it was fine.
I did. I had a little pick-me-up. I shoved some Bojangles chicken tendies in my mouth, some mashed potatoes and gravy.
Not a sponsor, but Bojangles. You want to sponsor us?
Oh, and I will say I'm very sad because I had them give us like a lot of their barbecue sauce and a lot of their ranch because Bojangles ranch is so fucking good. It's like Wingstop ranch. It's homemade. It's in-house.
I've never had either of those things.
It's so good. Like, okay, so Bojangles, like barbecue, comes like this, right? You got to like peel it. So it, like, it comes from a manufacturer.
Sure.
No, their ranch is in the little black cups with the pop lid.
It's homemade.
Because they make it in-house. They make that shit in-house. It's so good. So I was excited and my husband's making my plate and he's squirting that Hidden Valley shit in my little dip cup. And I said, no, I want the Bojangles ranch. And he said, honey, it's gone. I said, how are we all gone? Their cups are massive. And he's like, well, it was in the bucket of like chicken for so long and gotten so hot that like by the time they ate and everything, he's like, I didn't feel safe putting it back in the fridge. It would have been fucking fine.
It actually would have been probably fine.
I was so fucking mad. I didn't get my ranch.
Dang it,
Tyler. So I had to dip those tinnies in fucking Hidden Valley. The barbecue sauce that was fine. It saved it. But here we are. That's all right. Let's just jump into this. Let's just rip this damn Band-Aid off.
So we're at this point. I left off with they are starting to create Jonestown and Guyana, the heaven on earth.
Yes. Okay. I'm going to give you like a tiny summary in like three paragraphs. Okay. So, but for this episode, trigger warnings are mass murder, suicide, cult, brainwashing, and religious trauma. I'm sure there's a few more in there that I just didn't list. So just trigger warning everything. Just fucking everything. Okay.
So include what I said before on the other one.
Right.
Add it here.
Insert trigger warnings here. So at first, Jim Jones was a man, like we said, who claimed to hold powers beyond comprehension. He told crowds he could heal the sick and one time proved he could even heal this woman's broken leg by cutting off her cast and literally making her run across the room.
Mm-mm.
Newsflash, her leg was not healed. Most likely she caused more damage to her leg.
Probably.
By running on it when it wasn't fully healed and taking the fucking cast off. But anyways, okay. In the early days of the People's Temple, it felt like something good. Like we said, people loved it. This was something radical. This was something new. This was going against the grain. Jim preached about equality, justice, helping the poor, you know, being, like I said in part one, the hands and feet of Jesus. But over time, his sermons drifted away from the Bible and into more of fiery speeches about social activism.
It was thrilling for many, but also the first sign of like a really big shift when he really stepped away from the Bible as much,
mm-hmm.
or more of his preaching was very like, not just like activism radical, but like Jesus radical, like him saying, I am reincarnated of Mr. the Heavenly Divine, whatever guy, Father Divine.
Father Divine.
Yeah. As the church grew, Jim began to speak less like a pastor and more like a revolutionary politician. Politicians and even other activists who visited were painted as corrupt outsiders. So these Democrat activists are coming in
mm-hmm.
and they're like helping spread the same mission that Jim Jones is trying to push within his congregation and in society. But then they leave and he paints them as evil people.
Mm.
He convinces his congregation that they are out to control Jim Jones and everybody in People's Temple.
Because Jim Jones is the only one that's got it right.
Yeah, yeah. And so like they're wolf in sheep's clothing type thing. This is how he's making these people out to his followers.
Mm-hmm.
So he convinced his congregation they needed to create their own just society, a place where the evils of the world could not reach them and they could run to this place in the case of America's downfall or, in their beliefs, their America's inevitable downfall.
Yeah.
And their persecution, honestly. So like we said in part one, that is a place in Guyana. So in 1974, Jim began building a settlement deep in the jungles of Guyana. Over the next few years, more than 1,000 followers made the pilgrimage. When they arrived, it looked like paradise. They marveled at the wildlife. They worked side by side building homes, planting crops, and creating a community where no one had to pay rent, food was free, and healthcare was provided. They had clinics on site. They had nurseries for their children on site. They had education on site. Like, it was literally everything you would need without having to go anywhere. And for many, it was the utopia that Jim had promised. This was their land of milk and honey.
Mm-hmm.
But the promise came at a cost. Days began before dawn and ended long after sunset. Meals were little more than rice, eaten three times a day. There was no phone, no television, no contact with the outside world. And even when they got to Guyana, their passports were confiscated by Jim Jones himself.
That's right. Yeah.
What had been pitched to them as freedom and a sanctuary now was turning into their captivity. So when Jim finally arrived in Jonestown, because his followers had kind of, Jim didn't do shit. His followers went and built the whole thing, right? And then he.
Yeah, he waited and came after, right?
He came after. He came to Guyana. Officially in 1974. So what happened was all those articles Lola was telling you about in part one, the last article that he got word that was about to be published, there were actually ex-followers that decided, I'm going to put my name to this article
mm-hmm.
and I'm not going to be a silent, anonymous, you know, witness. I'm going to put my name to this, which gave the claims a lot more credibility.
Yeah.
And he knew that what was going to come out was going to not only just make people think negatively of Jim Jones, but also possibly have legal ramifications. And so he said, I got to get the fuck out of here. Peace out. I'm going to Guyana, because Guyana does not have extradition policies with the United States. So he literally got word of this coming out, and he peaced out to Guyana before the article even came out. When the article did come out, they did have enough evidence to charge him with some kind of money racketeering, something he would have been charged for.
Because all of that stuff with politicians was also coming out.
Like, yeah.
All of the, lobbying and stuff happening.
Yeah. And already people knew about he had a history of stealing money from a congregation. So they were able to bring charges, but they couldn't do anything about it because he's in Guyana. So
he escaped.
He never comes back to the U.S. after that. He's in Guyana now until he dies.
The end.
Yeah. Actually, I want to say 1974. I think it was actually 1973 that he actually officially arrived in Guyana. So when he arrives, after his followers, like I said, had spent months building it, he quickly seized control. Nightly meetings stretched for hours, hours upon hours, his voice filling the pavilion as he spoke off the cuff, like not organized, just off the cuff. And he drilled into their minds that
wanting anything for themselves was selfish and even ungodly. Only the collective was what mattered, and the collective needed to always come first. Soon, even personal relationships were forbidden. This is another flip when it comes to sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
Families and romantic partners were threats in Jim's eyes, because he's now, you think he had control before, now he has a warrant out for his arrest in the United States, and all those people are coming forward about the abuse that he and like they endured under his care.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's now seizing even more control. How can I keep people from dissenting? So now he's creating even more division. He began driving wedges between parents and children, lovers, and even friends. He was systematically breaking apart the very bonds that had brought these people to Jonestown in the first place. So soon, Jim's mask slipped even further. Survivors remembered his voice cutting like a whip. Quote, dumbass bitch, go sit down. Sit your ass down. According to Stephen Jones, his son, Jim, he said the cruelty became normal when it comes to Jim Jones.
Mm.
People were beaten, some were drugged, locked away for weeks in small rooms so that...
Deprivation chambered the box.
The box they had in the States, they had another one they built in Guyana, which right. I don't know if it was like a box or just a room that they were locked in. And they would literally be drugged.
Yeah.
And injected with drugs until they emerged days later, just like dazed and like fucking out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Many people said every day they just wish they had died in their sleep. Like it, they did not want to wake up and have to do another day. Because you also have to remember, they're in Guyana. It's fucking hot. It's humid. They got some bugs. They don't got no AC.
First of all, it's not an easy terrain.
No.
It's really hard to grow crops there also. Their main crops are rice and sugar.
Yeah, that's why they literally ate rice 3 times a day. And I don't know about you guys, but I eat rice. I'm hungry an hour later. That shit just goes right through me.
Yeah. I mean... It's just not like sustainable. They're living.
Mm-mm.
They went from the United States having money and like modern day luxuries, and now they're operating as if almost like a third world country.
Yeah.
So.
Mm-hmm.
And they're also not accounting for all the resources for the more people that are coming in, or more people that are like being born there, possibly.
Then came the White Knights. Have you ever heard of the White Knights?
No.
Okay. So in the middle of the night, a siren or a voice would summon everybody to come to the pavilion. And in the end, like 1,000 people were there with Jim Jones. Okay. So it's a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
Jim would declare an emergency warning of enemies closing in on their encampment. They would literally plan how to respond and how to survive, or even how to die.
So they're having drills.
They're having drills, yes. Guns and rifles literally line the perimeter of the pavilion, but they're not pointing outwards. They're pointing inwards at the people sitting in the pavilion.
Why?
They weren't just meetings. Like we said, there's drills. These are rehearsals. Sometimes these drills were even set up as a mass suicide test.
Oh, so he knew from the get-go.
Mm-hmm. Jim called these a test of faith. He literally would call it revolutionary suicide. Like, you're dying for your cause.
So you're all being martyrs for this?
Yes. He viewed it as you are being martyrs and you are just like ascending to the next life and for a better purpose.
Okay. So like this was, see, my thought was this came later on. But I guess from the get-go of Guyana and Jonestown, he literally had already formed the plan.
Yeah.
Everyone's going to die here. If you come here, you die here.
And it comes up later. But basically, like, Jim Jones' biggest crux was, like, he worried the most about how other people perceived him.
Of course.
He wanted to be able to know that the way people perceived him was good. And now that's...
Look at the way he dressed.
I know, right? Take all those fucking sunglasses. Good God.
The sunglasses? He dyed his hair black?
Oh, okay. This is what I was going to say. Okay, I didn't have this in my notes. The reason that he's like growing more paranoid, even in Lola's part at the end and like in this one, he's massively addicted to heavy drugs.
I saw something about that.
Heavy drugs.
Wasn't sure when he started that, though.
I think it was like one of the, if I'm remembering correctly, and I could be wrong, this is the one part I didn't like heavily research, but he, I think it was like an injury or something, or the paranoia
was getting to him because of all of the backlash they were getting when they were in Indiana.
I know he couldn't sleep for a while.
Okay, I do remember that. Yeah, he couldn't sleep, so he was taking some medication, and then it went on to hard drugs or something like that.
And then
he got addicted. Now, when Lola said that they had gotten attacked, there was a part in Indiana, when they lived in Indiana, where he called the cops because he said that somebody fired a gun at their house.
Yeah.
But the only bullet and bullet hole and casing they found was actually one that was fired like off the porch into the street as if he was firing back. But he was like, no, I didn't fire back. I didn't do anything. So Marceline believed that he created this as another thing to like convince his followers they've got to get out of Indiana and move to California.
Mm-hmm.
It was one more thing to just like make people fall into line with him and like believe him more and more. So yeah, he's heavily on drugs.
And to believe that they are fully misunderstood by the public, but understood by him.
Yes.
Because that also strengthens the like bond between cult leader and the audience.
Yeah. So he's having a religious psychosis. He's like...
on drugs.
On drugs. So he's having... like he's not in his right mind.
He's having visions of nuclear war still, probably.
He's paranoid as hell. It's like if the worst salad was being made and the worst ingredients were all being put together, and then he's just shugging that shit down like his candy, okay? That is Jim Jones.
No crouton in sight.
No.
Why did I say that?
No, absolutely not. You're right. There was none. Because that would have actually given some substance. And this man had no substance, right? So, yes, they are practicing to die. They are practicing to be faithful to not only Jim Jones, but to God, but more so to Jim Jones and showing him like his loyalty. Day by day, this fear and dependence on Jim in Jonestown deepened for everybody. Now, when they would have these like suicide trials or drills, they would literally be told like, this is poison, drink it.
Oh.
And everybody would drink it. But then it would turn out that it was just a drill and it was fake. So everyone kind of developed this like...
desensitization.
Yeah. And you're not really going to go through with it. Like,
yeah,
this is probably just a drill.
This is just a for show test. Like,
yeah.
Okay.
Now we're going to talk about a guy named Vernon Gosney. Okay. He joined the People's Temple in 1974 after his wife passed away. He might have joined earlier than that, but it was 1974 when he like joined the Guyana section of People's Temple and then moved into Jonestown. Okay. He brought his 8-year-old son with him, and he believed Jonestown would be a place to learn and grow and live out the ideals of socialism that he stood by. And what he found instead felt more like a guarded camp than a safe community. Before long, Vernon realized that Jonestown wasn't the place he had hoped for and began thinking about leaving. He ended up confiding in his roommate, only to learn that his roommate had once tried to escape himself, but was caught and severely punished for it. It was such a harsh punishment that it literally terrified the man to ever attempt leaving again. Ever.
Did he say what happened?
No, I could not figure out what happened to the roommate, but it was so bad. He was like, fuck this. I'm never trying to leave again. He was willing to deal with that torture because it was better than...
than whatever.
The torture or danger that he experienced whenever he was caught for trying to leave. So for Vernon, that conversation confirmed what he had already begun to suspect. He wasn't alone. Many people in Jonestown wanted to leave.
Didn't want to be there, but...
But fear and what might happen kept them from trying. By then, everyone knew the truth. Paradise was not paradise anymore. And in reality, it was a prison. And for many, it would become their grave. Now, this is where Grace comes back in. We talked about Grace in part one, Grace Stowen. Okay, I think that's how you say her last name. Okay. She had once been a very devoted follower of Jim Jones and People's Temple. For 6 years, she followed him, believing in his vision and his mission. But devotion came at a price. One night after a very long church service, this is back in, I think California was when she started going. But after a long church service, Jim forced everyone to stay awake for an all-night meeting at the People's Temple in the States. By 3 a.m, Grace was exhausted. And she started to close her eyes, but just for a moment. And then she awoke to find Jim standing over her, pressing a gun to her head, saying, I love you very much, but don't fall asleep.
Wow.
Yeah. You're in church and your pastor just held a fucking gun to your head for closing your eyes.
We had someone do that. They did pull a gun on the youth group one time, but not straight to their forehead.
I didn't tell you that. Sorry. I'll talk about it later.
What the fuck? Okay, that's going to be our palate cleanser, which is not a palate cleanser, but I need to know that story because what the fuck? I don't care if it's to their head. You don't pull a gun. Here we are. Why am I always so uncomfortable? Anyways.
Why is nothing good anymore?
This is why we can't have nice things. Ugh. Okay, so Grace eventually left the People's Temple, but leaving People's Temple didn't mean freedom for her. Her family and friends were still inside, and her own son had been taken away from her. Grace and her husband, Tim, had been a part of the temple's like inner circle for years, and they had an open marriage. And like we talked about in part one, Grace had been one of Jim Jones's mistresses. When she became pregnant, Jim forced both Grace and Tim to sign papers claiming that he was the father. He was not the father.
Okay, so John Victor is not his child.
No.
Okay.
No. From what they know.
All it said is he claimed this child.
Uh-huh. So from what they know, I don't know if a DNA test was ever done. I doubt it because of what happens. But yeah, they claim that Jim Jones forced them to sign papers saying he was. But they're like, he was not the father. And I think she might have been able to figure that out based off like who she was sleeping with when.
Probably, yeah.
And that's my guess. But, you know, who knows? Now, when they defected and left, because Grace and Tim both left the People's Temple, mm-hmm. Jim retaliated by taking their son and sending him to Jonestown. So they lost their son.
Oh.
Yeah. Grace fought desperately to get her son back. Along with other worried family members, she reached out to Congressman Leo Ryan, the fucking hero.
Oh, shit.
Okay. Pleading for help. They reported the starvation, the torture, the imprisonment, all of that was trickling out of Guyana. And Ryan, Congressman Ryan, he agreed. He's like, I'm going to fucking investigate because these people are my constituents and it is my responsibility and this is my duty. We're going to figure this out.
And that's a congressman.
That is a congressman.
Sit with that.
He stood on business, motherfucker. But Jim Jones got word, okay? He knew the congressman was coming and he began preparing. He staged interviews with all the members, forcing them to repeat glowing reviews and praise of life in Jonestown. On camera, they said things like, I do not want to go back to the States in no way, shape, or form. None of this would have been possible without Jim Jones. I love it here. But behind the spiles, nobody was daring to tell the truth.
Mm-hmm.
On Tuesday, November 14th. Okay, so a lot of stuff happens in between her going to congressman and him agreeing to say, yes, like, I will go, and then them actually going. I can't go down that rabbit hole. You guys can go down that rabbit hole yourself because there's just too much, okay? So we're going to skip ahead to Tuesday, November 14th, 1974. Congressman Leo Ryan and his aide Jackie Speer boarded a flight to Guyana. They were left to handle this investigation largely on their own.
Mm-hmm.
Congressman Ryan had sought support from the U.S. Embassy, but officials declined to get involved, and they cited separation of church and state and avoided releasing any information that they had on Jim Jones and Jonestown and Guyana out of fear that it could be seen as religious persecution or religious conflict like between church and state. And so they said, we're so sorry, use on your own, go forth and prosper.
When it comes to violence and things like that, I feel like you gotta...
I don't know who these people were, but I tell you right now, they all fucking regret that decision.
But they should.
Because what they should have done is they should have sent a handful of soldiers.
That's what I'm thinking. You should have like deployed the guard or something to help.
And I said they went in empty fucking handed. They went in empty fucking handed.
They were like lambs to slaughter.
Yeah. Literally. So joining Ryan and Jackie Speer were concerned relatives of temple members, several former followers, and a small press team. The press team included Don Harris from NBC, Tim Ritterman of the San Francisco Examiner, and Charles Cross of the Washington Post. I don't know if that's how you say his last name. So sorry. Ritterman, in particular, was already well acquainted with the story. He is the one who had been covering the accounts of escapes and sharing these warnings and telling the people's stories.
Nice.
Publicly and publishing it.
Mm-hmm.
So Jim Jones knew who Tim Ritterman was, and Tim was very familiar with Jim and Jonestown. Grace was also, Grace Stoen was, and Tim Carter also traveled with them on the plane. And she, Grace herself, warned everyone on the plane again and again and again, saying, you are walking into danger. You could lose your lives.
Oh,
she
man.
Wanted them to understand what they were walking into and how serious it was.
She knew.
But one of the NBC crew members brushed her off, actually telling her to just shut up after the third time of her warning them. To them, she was being dramatic. But to Grace, she was simply just telling them the truth. Like, you are literally walking into the most dangerous situation of your life. So many on the plane, they still believed that the rumors about Jonestown were exaggerated. They thought that Jim was just an eccentric man in black clothing.
He's just a weird hippie man.
Yeah, wearing his dark sunglasses, flanked by bodyguards. Maybe he's a paranoid guy, but he's not a monster by any means. Like, that's got to be rumors. It's not that bad. They would be sorely mistaken. So the group did not have an official invitation from Jim Jones, okay? When they landed, they were greeted not with open arms, but with a note from Jonestown and from Jim Jones saying, go away, leave. You're not invited. You're not coming. Go. Jim Jones branded the congressman as a fascist to his followers, warning his followers that the congressman had come to take them away as prisoners. He even prophesied that Ryan would never make it to Guyana and that his plane would fall from the sky like a wounded bird. Again, another prophecy that didn't come true because Jim Jones is a fucking liar.
That's all.
And he cannot prophesy.
Delusional. Very messed up in the head.
Yep. Congressman Ryan, he was determined. He's like, nope. I'm going to figure this out.
I don't need an invitation.
Yeah.
Shut that down.
Nice try. For 3 days, the delegation was stuck in Georgetown, which is a couple hours from where Jonestown was, trying to negotiate with Jim Jones and his lawyers in order to get entry into Jonestown. Meanwhile, we're going to talk about a man named Sherwin Harris, okay? He was also there as one of the concerned family members, and he was desperate to see his daughter. His daughter's name was Leanne, and she was living in Jonestown with his ex-wife, Linda. Now, her official name is Linda, but everybody at Jonestown called her Sharon because she wasn't allowed to be called Linda because Jim Jones knew somebody named Linda and he didn't like her. And so he made her change her name.
Actually, there were several members that had to change their name.
Oh, I believe it.
Or like, were given a new name.
Yeah, I read that and I was like, she is not the only one. Like, I know she can't be the only one. Now, they didn't specifically live in Jonestown. They lived in Georgetown at like, they had a headquarters, like a People's Temple headquarters in Georgetown in the city. And she lived in Georgetown. And that's where Sharon, Linda, this girl, and her daughter Leanne, and they had a couple other younger children of hers that I think, again, she had adopted. But he was desperate to see his daughter. He hadn't seen her in years. Linda, like, cut off contact with Leanne and Sherwin. And so he's just desperate, okay? Now, at the same time, he's trying to break into... see his, not really break in, but like
infiltrate,
get to see his daughter, infiltrate. Yeah. The cracks in the facade of Jonestown were beginning to show. Stephen Jones, Jim's son, was on the basketball team and they were scheduled to travel to Georgetown to do like a basketball tournament. Now, Jim tried desperately to stop them from traveling. Like he wanted all of them to stay at Jonestown, but Stephen and the basketball team weren't having it. They're like, this is good press. Like, we need to go. Like, it's going to be bad if we don't show up. Like, we got to go. Now, Jim feared that once they were away from Jonestown, especially with Congressman Ryan coming or already being there, that was going...
He's
going
to lose control.
Yeah. Like, his son and the others, they might see the truth. They might see the cracks outside. Because when you get out of the control of a group like that, it's really easy to start seeing through the rose-colored glasses, okay? But Marceline pushes back on Jim, and she's like, they need to go. Like, this is good. Just let them go. And she insisted, and Jim relented, which I'm kind of shocked he actually did. And when Stephen said goodbye to his father and to his mom and him lingered, and she had tears in her eyes as she said goodbye to him. He believes, and I agree with him, his mom was seeing the cracking of Jim Jones, and she knew that their time was limited. And she's trying to put a Band-Aid on a gaping wound.
Bullet hole.
Or like the biggest crack in a dam. She's trying to put a fucking Band-Aid over it, and it's just spewing everywhere. Like, it's not good.
But she always wanted to save him.
She did. She did. Mm-hmm. Others were beginning to think of escape. Vernon Gosney, the man I told you about earlier, who took his son to Jonestown.
Mm-hmm.
And his roommate that he had told that he wanted to escape, the roommate confided in another girl who was 18 and her name was Monica about their plan and like how Vernon wanted to escape. So they whispered in secret and they were like, we have to escape. We have to come up with a plan. So now their wheels are ticking.
I'm nervous.
Steven, since he is like Jones's son, right?
Mm-hmm.
He kind of comes from a unique position. And he would later confirm what so many survivors tried to tell the world. He confirmed in multiple interviews since that the healings were fake. The abuse was definitely happening. There was definite torture. And he went on and on. There was like major games of psychological warfare. It was bad. He was like, it was all true. It's all true. Now, inside Jonestown, Jim kept people compliant through fear, like we've said. Lola mentioned this in part one, and he used this same tactic. He would preach that concentration camps were literally being built in the United States for people of color to make those who had decided to come to Jonestown terrified to leave and go back home. He's like, you're going to be rounded up and shipped.
Oh, you think it's bad here? Just wait.
Yeah. He also would say that the Ku Klux Klan was controlling all of the businesses back home. So even if you didn't get put in a concentration camp, like, you'll get killed for go in the grocery store just because the Ku Klux Klan's running it, right?
Yeah.
So like we said, he left them no choice but to stay in Guyana. He also used nuclear war. They're going to have nuclear war. It's inevitable. We got to stay out here. We'll be safe out here. All the things. Now, to tighten his grip, Jim circulated a petition for every member to sign, demanding that Congressman Ryan stay out of Jonestown. Go away. We don't want you. And no one refused this, of course. Everybody signed it, agreeing, like, go away, Congressman Ryan. But even as Jim tried to barricade them in, Vernon and others began looking to the very congressman Jones was fearing. They hoped Congressman Ryan, his visit or hopeful visit, might finally be their chance and their ticket to get out of there and to get home.
Yep.
So Wednesday, couple days later, November 15th, or I guess it's the very next day after Congressman Ryan showed up. Congressman Leo Ryan arrives in Guyana that afternoon, and he met with People's Temple leaders at their headquarters in Georgetown. By chance, the Temple's basketball team, including Stephen Jones, was there when he showed up. And Stephen would later recall that his first impression of the congressman was that he was outgoing, charismatic, and seemed like a very genuine person. And he even made the comment, like, you don't get people like that in Jonestown, especially after all of this torture and fear and everything. So Congressman Ryan asks to speak with Jim Jones directly, but he's turned away. He's given the cold shoulder. He's forced to leave. Okay. Back in Jonestown, Jim caught wind of the meeting and he's freaking the fuck out. You think he was paranoid then? He's paranoid now. He is full blown losing his ever loving shit. And through the radio room, he issued strict orders. That basketball team was to return home immediately. Get back to Jonestown right now. I don't care. Stephen pushed back, though, because he's like, we still have games. And he reminded his father, like, we are good public relations for Jonestown. Like, we are not going home. And Stephen refused. And that pissed Jim off so much. Marceline even got on the line. It was like, you need to get home. Like, things are really bad here. Like, you need to get home. He said, no.
Go off, Stephen.
Behind that small act of defiance was a deeper truth. Stephen had admitted he had known for years that his father was unhinged, unfucking hinged. Watching his drug use spiral, he believed Jim didn't have long to live. He literally was like, he wasn't only going to live for a couple more months after this. Like, he was so riddled with drug abuse and paranoia. It wasn't going to last. But like we said, when Stephen refused to return, Jim teetered closer to that edge of paranoia. And as Stephen put it later, There was no denying he was losing control. So next day, Thursday, November 16th, Congressman Ryan and his team of lawyers pressed Jim Jones for access to Jonestown. What was intended to be a quick discussion, well, stretched to 3 days of this whole back and forth, okay? Ryan, I love this congressman. He wasted no time in calling out what he'd seen at the Temple headquarters in Georgetown. He told the lawyers that when he visited People's Temple headquarters, there wasn't a single sign of religious practice. No prayers were happening. There were no crosses, no religious decorations, nothing that hinted at any kind of faith. And so he's like, I find that concerning. So, you know, when I get back to the States, like, I'm just gonna have to really like look into this and really look into your tax exempt status, because it doesn't really look like you're a religious organization. So
damn,
really hate to have to revoke that. But, you know, if I have to.
He's going for the kneecaps.
He did. And he was like, the lawyers left, went and talked to Jim Jones. And then all of a sudden they come back and they're like, okay, you can go visit Jonestown.
Yep.
And that was exactly.
Yep.
So during that talk, like, one of the lawyers basically laid it out for Jim. They were like, you've got two choices. One, tell the congressman to go to hell and that'll be the end of it. Okay. Go to hell. Get the fuck out of here. But he was like, I won't represent you anymore because you are losing your shit. And so he said, two, I will represent you, but you let them in and let them see Jonestown for themselves with their own eyes and get this over with. So I think between all of that, Jim finally relented. So then Jim's given the orders. Yes. Okay, fine. I give you the invitation. You can come. And next he sends the orders down to his people. Clean this motherfucking place up. And so then everybody's rushing, they're painting, they're cleaning, they're making it look like this, you know, paradise place where everything's put together and everything's perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Now, also during this time, there were rehearsals and people were literally lined up and drilled asking questions. Okay, what do you respond to this? What do you respond to that? What do you respond to this? And it was always like, it has to be positive. You love it here. Everything's great. We have a community here. I don't want to go to the back to the United States. No, there's no abuse, XYZ. Like, they practice it. And you can imagine this is all happening within a day or two before Congressman Ryan even arrives.
It's so exhausting.
So when the hell do these people sleep?
They don't.
Between cleaning and being interviewed and having to rehearse?
I don't feel like they get to sleep like a normal person anyway.
Oh,
like beyond
not.
This, because like,
yeah,
the amount of work that it takes to make a community like that work.
Yeah.
And then along with his other needs that they may be, you know, having to cater to.
Yeah, exactly. Sherwin Harris, who I was talking about, was trying to see his daughter, Leanne. He was staying at a hotel in Georgetown and he was anxiously hoping for a chance to see his daughter, Leanne. Now, his ex-wife, Sharon, who was still, like I said, very close-knit with Jim Jones, called him one day and finally said, you can see Leanne. That's fine. So he's like, well, okay, that's fine. I'm not going to go to Jonestown. Like, there's no reason for me to go to Jonestown. I'll stay here and I will meet you wherever you want. Like, I will do whatever you want. I just want to see Leanne. And so they set up a date that he was going to come Saturday at 2 p.m. to the People's Temple headquarters in Georgetown, or they called it like Llama Garden. So I don't know if that was like a section of Georgetown or nearby Georgetown or whatever. But so he's like, they make that date. And he was excited. He was like, oh my God, I'm finally getting to see her. Nervous, of course, but like still very excited. Like, this is a step forward. This is more than we've gotten, more progress than we've ever been able to make. Friday, November 17th, Congressman Ryan charters a plane to carry himself, the press, and relatives of Jonestown members and a few temple representatives more than 150 miles into the heart of the Guyanese jungle. Their destination was a remote airstrip in Port Kaimu that was just 5 miles away from Jonestown. Not everyone came. This is what's really sad. Grace Stowen and her husband, Tim, did not get on the plane because they didn't have enough seats. And since they had had that history with Jim, and there was already so much tension,
they thought they'd make it worse.
They decided they would stay back in Georgetown to give the group a better chance at actually being able to get into Jonestown.
Yeah, yeah.
So they wait in Georgetown. And unfortunately, they never get to see their son.
Yeah.
Again.
Yeah.
that part broke my freaking heart. That's all they wanted. They just wanted their son. They just wanted their son back. So as the small plane approached the dirt runway, the pilot received a chilling message.
Ugh.
Jonestown had declared that the airstrip was unserviceable. You can't land. Sorry. It's airstrip's broken.
We broke the ground.
The dirt isn't dirting. So the pilot's like, that's weird. So he like does a few circles and they're like, seems fine to me. So they land. And of course it was fine. It was just a ploy for them to try to not gain entry. Now, back at Jonestown, Vernon Gosney was carrying out a secret plan. He knew.
Yeah.
Congressman Ryan was coming. So he said, we're going to escape. Him and the 18-year-old girl named Monica were like, we are going to try to escape and we're going to use the congressman to try to do it. So they decided that they would write a letter, a note, basically just simple note. Vernon Gosney and Monica, I think her name was Beasley, her last name. Want out, need help. That's all it said. And they were determined that while the congressman was there, they were going to slip him that letter.
Yeah.
And get the fuck out of Jonestown.
This is brave. This is scary.
Back at the airstrip, the group is waiting while a flatbed truck of People's Temple members appeared. Now, when they got there, they tried to say that Jim Jones said they couldn't come anymore. They were trying to, again, back out of their agreement to let him go. But Charles Gary, Jim Jones's lawyer, said, the fuck you are let know the fuck you are. He said, I am taking them. They are getting in. They are going to see Jonestown. And it's on my head if he gets pissed. I'll take it.
That's a brave lawyer.
I know. I was like, your balls dropped that day. Okay.
You know Jim. You work with him like you know him.
Yeah. So he took Congressman Ryan. And he might have taken a couple of the crew members, and they went first. And they said, do not leave this airstrip to the family members. Do not leave. Do not try to come to Jonestown without us coming back to get you. Don't try it. And so the families left there while Congressman Ryan and a couple of the crew members go. Hours passed before the truck returned. Eventually, all the family members that were there were allowed to climb aboard, but the ride ahead would prove grueling. What looked like a short distance, it's only 5 miles. It took them more than 5 hours to cover.
Why?
Like, that's how, because it's so remote.
Mm.
You're in the jungle. It's not a road.
True.
It's a tiny dirt airstrip in the middle of fucking nowhere. And you're taking these big ass trucks through.
I have no like visual for it. So I think that's why I'm like, why did that take so long? But yeah.
So the only reason I have somewhat of an actual visual is I've been to Panama and I've been to the jungles of Panama and they are so fucking dense. Nothing is flat. Everything's wet. And trying to walk up a hill, you're slipping and falling down. So I'm trying to think of like an actual heavy ass truck you're trying to get through there.
Yeah.
How hard it would be. And like, are you getting stuck? You're possibly getting stuck. Like, it sounds like a
gotcha. Yeah.
Hot mess.
Yeah.
Now, for the congressmen, the reporters, and the families, the realization set in very slowly, but very heavily. Jonestown wasn't just remote. It was a fortress of isolation buried deep in the Guyanese forest, entirely cut off from the outside world. Every mile they traveled made it clearer. This was Jim Jones' domain, and everyone inside lived under his control. Can you imagine trying to trek through 5 miles of dense forest to escape? You would die before you even made it out. You'd have to very much know where you were going. And a lot of these people didn't. They had no idea. So when the delegation first arrived in Jonestown, they were honestly really impressed with what they had built. In the middle of nowhere, in the deep forest, they had built this amazing place that looked extraordinary at the first glance. There was a clinic, a nursery, a school, neatly, you know, designed rows of, you know, crops that they were building, communal spaces for living. It did, on the surface, look beautiful. But that evening, the community gathered in the central pavilion for a party. There was music, there was laughter, and food filled the air. It was just amazing. And this was the first time Jim Jones made an appearance. They had not seen him all day. He did not show up till the party at the pavilion. Congressman Ryan, he was invited to speak, and his words were very carefully chosen, but he explained that, like, why he was there. But then he added, quote, "From the conversations I've had, many people here believe this is the best thing that ever happened to them," end quote. Now, the reaction to that statement was immediate and unnerving, because the entire pavilion erupted in loud cheer and clapping and shouting and hooting and hollering. But it wasn't just like, yeah, woo, okay, blah, blah, and then it ends. It went on and on and on and on and on and on. I'm not kidding. I'm not fucking kidding. The congressman is standing there, like, awkwardly smiling and trying to, like, get another word in, but can't, because nobody will shut the fuck up and stop cheering. The entire film crew was like, that was the moment for them that was like, oh, something's really fucked up here. Like, this wasn't just overcompensating. This was like taking overcompensating and making it do three lines of cocaine. Like, this was insane. So everyone's like, that's weird, but okay. Now, journalists at that same party, they tried to question Jim Jones. And Jim, during his questioning, started to spiral. He would begin answering their questions, but then he'd like veer off into like paranoid rants. They're trying to hurt us. They're out to get us. The ex-members just are destroying what we've built, you know, taken so long and done so hard to build, you know. To the reporters, it was deeply disturbing, because he'd be like, blah, 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 and then go off on his tangent and then try to come back and somewhat answer the question. And they were like, it was clear this man was losing his daggum mind. Now, before Congressman Ryan got up and did his little speech, Vernon was desperate to slip the congressman this letter.
The note, yeah.
But he didn't know who the congressman was. He had never seen a picture of him.
That's true, yeah.
So he's having to look at this group being like, do you look like a congressman?
Who looks most important?
Who looks like the most important man here? And he knew that the risk he was taking, like, if he was caught passing this note, he's going to die. Like, he's like, they're going to kill me.
Yeah.
They don't give a shit. Bury me in the Guyanese forest. Nobody will ever know I'm here.
No one will find it. Yeah, no one will know.
But he's like, I can't stay silent. I can't stay. I got to get out. And so he tried to slip the note very discreetly into this man's, like, crossed arms. This man's arms were like this, and like where the elbow is, creases on the inside. He tried to like slip it right there, but it didn't stay. The note fell to the ground.
No.
And the moment the note falls to the ground, a little boy goes, he's passing a note.
No. No.
So Vernon desperately tries to like save the moment. And so he bends down, picks up the note, hands it to this man and says, oh, you dropped this. And then turns around and walks away, trying to play it off like, I didn't pass him a note. I just picked up his shit that he dropped. Thankfully, nobody caught it, so he was okay in this moment.
Huh.
But he did not pass the note to Congressman Ryan. Instead, he passed it to a man named Don Harris, who was part of the film crew.
Mm.
So, or he was a reporter himself.
Mm-hmm.
So Don unfolded the paper a little bit later, and it said, Monica and Vernon Gosney want out, need help. Moments later, another Temple member secretly handed him a second note. These people had not talked, okay? Other people were having the same fucking idea.
And they happened to give it to the same guy.
And they go to the same guy.
Wow.
I don't know if this person saw him pass the note to Don, and so then they, yeah.
Maybe, yeah.
So Tom Bogue, he's a younger kid. He was like teens.
Mm-hmm.
He was one of the Jonestown youths, and he noticed that girl passing the note to the journalist. And he said his blood ran cold. Members were not allowed to talk to or have direct contact with the congressman or the press. And he knew in that moment, something was going, shit was hitting the fan.
Yeah.
Yeah. He had lived in Jonestown since he was 5 years old, and he hated every single minute of it. He said it was horrific from day one. And he went straight to his dad and was like, that bitch passed him a note. And his dad was like, let's get the family. And in that moment, they were like, we got to go. We got to leave, because this is not going to be good. people are leaving and Jim's going to lose his shit. And like, we have to take care of our family. So they're like, one way or another, we're fucking out.
Mm-hmm.
That night, the delegation, so Congressman Ryan and the team, they did not stay at Jim at Jonestown. Instead, they had to be, they were forced. The Jim was like, you're not staying on the compound. He made them return to the Port Ketuma airstrip.
Mm-hmm.
And they were housed there by some of the locals. As they were sleeping at 3 a.m., the sheriff came in and confirmed their fears that Jonestown members had tried to escape and had been caught and taken back to Jonestown.
Mm-hmm.
So they knew that this was not peaceful. People wanted out and they were being forced to stay.
Uh-uh.
And now they have to return the next day. Not sure what the fuck they're about to walk into. Okay. So Saturday, November 18th, the next morning, the delegation prepared to return to Jonestown. They waited nervously at the airstrip for the truck to arrive. Everyone felt the tension, and too many people had whispered about leaving the night before, and no one knew what kind of storm they were fucking walking into, especially knowing, like I said, that those people had tried to escape. NBC sound recordist Stephen Sung later recalled how journalist Don Harris was determined to get back there and confront Jim Jones directly. He's like, I want fucking answers. He was ready. And they get back. And he showed Jim Jones the note from Vernon.
No!
Yeah, because they had been interviewing him. They had sat down when they got back and started interviewing.
Yeah.
And he was like, what do you have to say? People want to leave. What do you have to say about people wanting to leave? And shows him the note. And Jim looks at it and he goes cold. He was pissed. And he goes, well, if Jonestown's so bad, why does he want to leave his son here? Because he never mentioned wanting to take his son. It was just him and Monica who wanted to leave. And Jim was pissed. And things got awkward. Tim Carter, he had been in the temple for 6 years. I think I had said Tim Carter earlier when I was talking about Tim Stowen, Grace Stowen's ex-husband, or her husband. Tim Carter's are different. There's too many fucking Tims in this story, so I mixed them up.
Okay.
So just get that straight. Sorry.
That's okay.
Tim Carter, he's a temple member and a current temple member, and he's at Jonestown. He'd been a part of the temple for 6 years, and he was watching closely, and this was the moment that he knew changed Jim. His face tightened, his jaw clenched, his anger simmered to the surface. Every name, every person wanting to leave was another betrayal, another knife in Jim's back, and he was taking every single one of them personally.
Mm-hmm.
The more people spoke of leaving, the closer and closer he came to his breaking point. As the interview went on, the tension was palpable to everybody around. Jim's words grew sharper, his paranoia even grew thicker. Everybody could feel it. His sanity, his calm, his demeanor, everything was slipping away. Back in the United States, this footage would now not portray the utopia that Jim had claimed, because they're not just interviewing him and gonna write an article. There's cameras capturing all of this.
Mm-hmm.
And he knew that the perception of him and Jonestown was going to shit.
Yeah.
And remember, that's what he cares the most about, is people's perception of him and what he created.
It's the final bit of control that slipped from him.
And he could not have that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Stephen Jones, his son, reflected on these moments later in life, saying his father's entire sense of worth was tied into other people's perception of him. That means the attention always had to be on him. And Stephen explained, on this day, the attention was on those who wanted to leave, not on Jim. And he couldn't handle that either.
Yeah.
Jim's madness, he said, had always been there, hidden under a facade of charisma. He was a drug addict with no boundaries, no moral lines he wouldn't cross. From the moment new members arrived in Jonestown, Jim stripped them of their freedom, passports confiscated. And when anyone dared even ask or mention anything about going home, Jim would lash out. To one man, he said, it's blasphemy to talk about leaving when you haven't been given approval. Then he'd mock them. Do you want to go home? And if they answered no, he'd sneer and then say, then shut your mouth. Be seated and don't be in my face anymore. Just somebody, like, this was from a man. This was his response to a man asking to go home and just visit his family for the holidays or something like that. Like, what the fuck? So one by one, defectors began gathering their belongings. Jackie Spear, Ryan's aide, escorted one woman back to her cabin. A temple guard stood at the door, clearly trying to block her from leaving or getting in and getting her stuff. But since Jackie was there, the woman was able to push through and get her stuff, and the word spread, and more people just kept coming forward that they wanted to leave.
Mm-hmm.
So the desperation boiled over in one of the most heartbreaking scenes, which is actually captured on camera. One family was literally torn apart. The father was trying to leave and the mother wanted to stay, and their child was caught in the middle, and it was literally a game of tug of war.
Oh my God.
The father pulling one arm and the mom pulling the other of their child. It was tragic. Jim hovered close to the defectors, circling them, pleading, quote, "I can't believe you're leaving me. You're my whole world."
Sounds like a needy ex.
Yeah. Manipulation. But Jackie, we fucking love Jackie Spear. She is a fucking goat. And she stood on business and she held firm and she made it very clear to Jim, these people are going home. She even had them on camera, each person give a verbal declaration that they want to go home. Like, she had it covered. By mid-afternoon, the number of defectors had grown to 15, far more than anyone expected. With this, that meant there weren't enough seats on the small plane waiting at the airstrip. Another flight had to be ordered just to hold all of those who wanted to leave.
Mm-hmm.
Congressman Ryan made the decision to stay behind at Jonestown and wait for the second plane because he wanted to ensure that every last person who wanted freedom and wanted to leave could. So he was going to stay behind while the whole team went.
What a man.
Among the defectors was Tom Bogue and his family, the little boy who saw the girl pass the note to Don Harris. Yeah. Tom and his family had joined the group of defectors heading for the planes. For Tom, or Tom, it's T-H-O-M, so I just keep calling him Tom. I'm not sure how you say it.
Hmm.
It was a relief to finally be leaving, but the relief was poisoned with fear because he knew Jim Jones wasn't done. Jim Jones was not going to let them go quietly, and he was terrified. Every single defector on that truck was terrified. As the first group prepared to leave, a roar of voices erupted from the pavilion as their truck was pulling away. Don Harris leapt off the truck and ran towards the pavilion, camera crew in tow. Something was happening, and they needed to figure out what happened. A few minutes later, Congressman Ryan appears walking back to the truck with blood smeared on his shirt.
Mm.
A temple member had attacked him, lunging a knife at him and holding it to his throat, snarling, "I'm going to kill you." In the struggle, another temple member was able to wrestle the knife away, but in that moment, he injured the attacker. And so it was the assailant's blood that was on the congressman's shirt.
Mm.
And that's when the congressman went, "Fuck this, I'm not staying. I'm in so much danger right now. We're all leaving. Like, this is not safe for any of us. Like,
yeah,
we got to get the fuck out of here." So even as the truck rattled down the dirt path, Vernon and every other defector was gripped with fear. Freedom felt so close, but the danger felt even more intense. Inside the pavilion, Tim Carter, who had been with Jim Jones and the group for years, was shocked as he watched that whole thing unfold and the congressman almost be murdered in front of him. And then Jim spoke and Tim's blood ran cold because with a calmness and a chill in his voice, Jim said, "I've never seen Jonestown so peaceful."
No.
Tim's like, "We just watched somebody try to murder the congressman and you're saying this is fucking peaceful? We're all stressed the fuck out. What is wrong with you?"
So he's like fully snapped.
Mm-hmm. And then Jim just leaned back and added, almost casually, "I think someone might do something."
Oh, yeah. He's like certifiable.
Lost his ever-loving marbles. So they arrive at 4:45 p.m. at Port Kaituma airstrip.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the group of defectors waited for the second plane. Every minute felt like an hour.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
The air was thick with dread. They were terrified, and everybody was whispering about what Jim was possibly going to do. It only lasted 15 minutes until around 5 p.m. the second plane arrives. Families scrambled with their belongings, jittery, wide-eyed, desperate to climb aboard. Now, the film crew and everybody was like patting every single person down to try to like,
mm-hmm.
are these defectors or are these like spies or moles, you know, that are going to like fucking try to kill us, right?
For sure.
Everyone was on pins and needles. And there was one man, I can't remember his name, but there was one man who last minute was like, I want to go, and jumped on the truck. And Vernon was like, I know he's not a defector. I fucking know he's not a defector.
Yeah.
So they had a small plane and a larger plane. Vernon got put on the small plane with this defector.
It's about to get so bad.
So bad. It's so bad.
Oh my God. It's about to get so, like.
I know.
Okay.
So as they're trying to load and pat everybody down and like get them on the planes, at 5:20 p.m., a flatbed truck roared onto the dirt airstrip and an armed set of gunmen from Jonestown called the Red Brigade were on board. The men quickly jumped off with rifles raised, and before anyone could even process what they saw or what the fuck was happening, the men started shooting. Tom Bogue and his family had already been ushered onto the larger plane and had become trapped amongst the gunfire that's happening outside. Bullets tore through the air. NBC cameraman Bob Brown was struck first, collapsing onto the ground. His camera was still rolling and captured the chaos of the attack until the lens ended up dropping and hit the dirt and it broke. The airstrip became a storm of screams and gunfire. Congressman Leo Ryan was hit and fell. Jackie Speer, Ryan's young aide, dove to the side of the plane and tried pressing her body up against one of the wheels and hide herself, which, like, those are small. They're not very big. You know, this is not a huge, you know, like, commercial
fight. You do what you can when you got nothing else to hide behind.
But she is, like, think small, be small, hide behind this wheel. Like, she's trying desperately to hide. She was shot. She was bleeding and she was terrified. And she just, in that moment, she was like, this is the end. I'm dying. This is it. So she recited the act of contrition. It's a part of the Catholic religion.
Yeah.
Because she really did believe, like, I'm coming to see you, Father. Jesus coming home kind of thing.
Yeah.
Inside the big plane, bullets ripped through the metal fuselage. The woman sitting just behind Tom and his family, she was shot in the head and her brain matter just fell splattering to his feet. Horror washed over him and his family. His father had already told him earlier in the day, if anything happens, grab your sisters, and run to the forest. Just get the fuck in the forest. And so he jumped into action. He grabs his sisters and they run off, sprinting to the tree line. Nearby, the journalist Tim Ritterman was struck in the arm and the wrist as he dove for cover. He managed to scramble into the jungle where he ripped off his belt and cinched it tight around the wounds, trying to slow the bleeding. As Tom and his sisters like stumbled deeper into the forest, adrenaline was masking his fear. And then he suddenly realized he'd been shot. A large portion of his entire leg was missing. Missing. But he still pushed through it. He had so much adrenaline and he was dragging his sisters deeper and deeper into the thick brush. Charles Cross, he was another journalist. He felt the impact of a bullet slam into his side and the force was so staggering. He ended up dropping and gasping as the gunfire just raged around him. And then out of nowhere, silence. And everyone didn't dare move a muscle. If you were on the ground, you played dead. You didn't move. You waited. And then they heard three gunfires very systematically, one after another, after another, with minimal, like with a decent pause in between the three.
Mm-hmm.
They were executing a few people on the ground, one of which was Congressman Ryan. They had walked up and shot him directly in the head, making sure that Congressman Ryan did not survive. Steve Sung, he stayed pressed into the ground, bracing for the fatal shot. He could tell. Everybody knew they are walking around executing us one by one. We are about to die. But miraculously, that shot never came. They only executed, like, did the final execution of three people and then left. Why? I don't fucking know. But they did. When the gunfire stopped, five lay dead. Congressman Leo Ryan, NBC correspondent Don Harris, the defector named Patricia Parks, San Francisco Examiner photographer Greg Robinson, and NBC cameraman Bob Brown. Everyone else had survived but was gravely injured.
Mm-hmm.
The wounded were then dragged off the tarmac and hidden in tall grass, terrified that the gunmen would be circling back. A little later, the locals gave them shelter in a tiny rum shop and a cabin where they tried to just treat their horrific wounds with nothing more than alcohol. That's all they had.
Yeah.
And one time the guy like tried to pour, it was Sung,
mm-hmm.
Stephen Sung. He tried to pour the rum and like alcohol on his wound. And the guy was like, no, that's to drink. Guzzle it. No, we're not wasting it on your wounds. Get drunk. Like, just numb the fuck out of that pain.
I mean,
yeah, that's all you have. That's all you have.
Yeah.
Because it's like, okay, that rum's going to last like maybe 10 minutes, if that, disinfecting. And then she don't get dirty again. You're in the fucking jungle.
Yeah.
Give yourself a buzz. It'll last longer. Then, as they're sitting there, one of the planes that's empty just takes off into the sky. Flown by the pilot, alone, leaving the survivors stranded. When this shooting took place, the small plane of defectors was already full and waiting for the large plane to load so they could take off.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That last defector that was like, I want to leave. He was a mole and he pulls out a gun on that small plane. Somehow, I don't know the exact story and how it happened, but they were able to get the gun away from him, but they were still injured. I think it was like Vernon himself, the guy who was trying to leave.
Yeah.
Also, Vernon did leave his son at Jonestown. And he signed papers like allowing Jim Jones and Jonestown to keep his son. But Jim Jones had brainwashed them so bad that the United States was such an unsafe place for people of color.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
He was a white man and his son was half black. And so he literally thought that his son was going to be treated better at Jonestown and have a better life than in America.
That, yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's his biggest regret. And he openly talks about how like he has so much shame even to this day over it. And I'm like, you were brainwashed, honey.
And it's a little bit also with the oxygen mask on the airplane thing.
Yeah.
Sometimes you have to save yourself first.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that there's like a right way to do things in this scenario. It's survival. And survival sometimes means...
It's not black and white.
Bad decision sometimes. But like...
Yeah.
If you're caught between a bad decision and a worse decision, what are you going to do?
Exactly.
So...
Exactly. It's not black and white. So back in Jonestown, the tractor returned from the airstrip with grim news. Jim Jones called a white knight. A code everyone in Jonestown was very familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
Quietly, obediently, nearly 1,000 people filed into the pavilion. Jones appeared manic, pacing, eyes wide, and he announced that the Congressman Ryan had been killed, declaring the Red Brigade has done us justice. All the traitors are dead, end quote. Tim Carter, still inside the community, felt his stomach twist. He had once believed in Jonestown, believed in the dream of building something different. Now, in an instant, that dream was gone and murder had replaced it.
Yep.
Meanwhile, Tom and his sisters had made it about a mile into the dense jungle. Night fell and the darkness was so completely black they couldn't see more than an inch in front of their own hand. Exhausted and bleeding, they froze. Not sure what to do, not sure where to go, because he knew if they took the wrong step, they were dead.
Mm-hmm.
And so they just stayed still and waited. At the rum shop, survivors tried to tend to the gravely wounded with, like I said, bottles of rum, Jackie Spear lay bleeding from two bullet wounds in her arm and had catastrophic damage to her leg. Steve Sung called out into the night crying for his wife in the silence. Vernon Gosney had drifted in and out of consciousness in the bush. I'm not sure if he was actually able to make it to the rum shop or if he wasn't found until later that night, but he literally like woke up to somebody like looking for survivors in the woods. So inside the rum shop, defectors whispered about what could come next. They started talking about the white night drills. Charles Cross and Jackie Spear were like,
what's that?
The fuck you talking about, white night? What the hell is a white night?
Yeah.
And so they started talking about it and talking about the drinking of the poison. And that's when they realized, oh, fuck, we're not the only ones in danger. Everybody at Jonestown, every single person is in danger right now.
Everybody here.
And they're gravely wounded with no access to the outside world. So they have to wait. And wait. And wait. For years, Stephen Jones, Jim's son, had believed that his father was too much of a coward to ever actually go through with this whole, like, revolutionary suicide that he so was fascinated with.
Yeah.
But as we know, he was not. Now, also, during this time that the shooting and everything is happening at the airstrip, we're going to go back to Georgetown, to the Jonestown Temple headquarters, okay?
Yeah.
Sherwin Harris, he goes to see his daughter. He goes have that meeting at 2 o'clock, and it was amazing. They embraced, they loved, he was on cloud nine. Oh my gosh, you're actually letting me see my daughter. This is like, no time has passed. They invite him in. He stays for hours catching up with his daughter. They even have dinner. Everything is going so good. They're even making plans for the next day. But then, in the middle of dinner, Sharon comes in. Sharon, Linda, whatever the fuck you want to name her, comes in and tells Leanne she has a call in the other room. She goes into the other room, and that's when Sharon informs her that it is time. Jim Jones has called the official White Knight suicide mission. Leanne looked at her coldly and blankly and said, okay. Sharon said, you need to get rid of your father. Like, we need to get him to leave. So Leanne goes back out, tells her father that, like, I'm so sorry. Like, we had something come up that we got to attend to. Like, you have to go. So they walk him outside. And mind you, this whole time Sharon and Leanne are having this conversation, Stephen Jones is there in the room listening. And he's in disbelief that, like, his father's actually calling this. Like, he's, like, kind of, like, in denial mode of, like, no, there's no. There's no way. This isn't real.
Yeah.
This is another test. So they walk outside to tell Sherwin bye and walk him to his car. They make plans to go, I think it was, like, fishing the next day. And Sherwin says he sees Stephen pissed walk out of the house and, like, drive off, because Stephen is terrified of what's about to happen at Jonestown. He's trying to get there to like see if everyone's okay or like what the hell's going on or like try to make contact or something. He just was like, I got to figure this out, and leaves. And so they tell Sherwin bye and Sherwin leaves. Leanne and Sharon go back inside. Sharon gathers her kids along with a very large kitchen knife, and they go up to a bedroom upstairs, where Sharon then brutally murders her two younger children, and then Leanne and Sharon slit each other's throats.
I don't understand. Why didn't they just do the what? Sorry. That, I mean, that's not...
Because they're in Georgetown, so they're they're like hours away on plane.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm still thinking.
So
okay.
They, since they're so far away from Jonestown, they don't do the typical...
I gotcha.
...suicide.
I see.
This was their version of suicide. So after the ambush at the airstrip, Jim Jones made his move. He had ordered his men to, like we said, kill Congressman Ryan, knowing full well how it would play out. Now he could tell his followers, you have killed a U.S. congressman. No country will ever take you back.
Yeah, this is it.
You're in just as much shit as we are. No one will ever want to protect you, and there's no going back. It was the ultimate act of manipulation. to get his followers to finally officially take the poison.
Yeah.
He had effectively cut off every single fucking exit these people might have remotely had.
Mm-hmm.
And then he burned them on fire.
Tell me, do you know what the poison was that they...
Yes, we're going to get to that.
Okay.
So security guards encircled the pavilion,
mm-hmm.
rifles slung across their shoulders. No one was leaving. At 7 p.m., temple member Tim Carter sat with his wife, Gloria, and their baby son, Malcolm. He watched Jim and one of the guards arguing. "There's got to be another way," the guard said. But Jim's mind was set. Tim later recalled feeling split in two. Part of him believed Jim was about to kill everybody. The other part of him couldn't accept it. He was clinging to the hope that this is just another drill. This is just another drill. This is just another drill. And Jones tries to next cloak all of this in his affection and make it seem like this is the loving thing to do. He says, quote, "How very much I've loved you. How very much I've tried to give you the good life. But in spite of all I've done, a handful of our people and their lies have made our life impossible. We can't go back. They're going to send more congressmen. There's no way we can survive. If we can't live in peace, then let's die in peace. This isn't suicide. It's a revolutionary act." Tim Carter was paralyzed. He was torn between the instinct to fight for his life and the crushing sense that death was unavoidable. He could fight in that moment and then he'd just be shot.
Mm-hmm.
So he's stuck. And then in the midst of the chaos, one of Jones's mistresses leaned over and whispered that Jim had a final mission for Tim and that he needed to follow her. So Jim Jones had funneled all of the rest of the temple's money that they had earned or had into the Soviet Union as one of his last ways to like stick it to the USA.
Mm-hmm.
So Tim was ordered to serve as the carrier.
Yeah.
And they packed three suitcases full of cash, and his task was to deliver them to the Soviet embassy. Even as Tim was being given like this bizarre assignment, a woman stood up in the crowd and said, quote, "I don't want to die." She said, "I'm not afraid of death, but I look at the babies and I want them to live." Jones stared at her coldly and flatly and said, "It's too late. If you knew what was ahead of you, you'd be glad to die." A group then lethally mixed together potassium cyanide, sedatives, and tranquilizers. It was then blended into like a fruit-flavored drink that was so-called a medicine. And it was kind of like what we would consider Kool-Aid, but it was a cheaper version that was in Guyana.
Mm-hmm.
But it's effectively
mm-hmm.
a powdered Kool-Aid.
Gotcha.
They made cups. They had syringes. They had syringes they attached to needles. They had it all. Some stepped forward with some resistance. Some stepped forward without resistance. And some tried to refuse desperately. But there was no escape. Jones' voices thundered over the loudspeakers. "Lay down your life with dignity. Lay down without tears and agony. I tell you, I don't care how many screams you hear. I don't care how many anguished cries. Death is a million times preferable to 10 more days of this life. If you knew what was ahead of you, you'd be glad to be stepping over. If we can't live in peace, then let's die in peace. We didn't commit suicide. We committed an act of revolutionary suicide, protesting the conditions of an inhumane world." Now, by the time Tim Carter had returned to the pavilion, I am not sure if this is before he goes to the embassy or after he goes to the embassy. I'm assuming it's before because the timeline just doesn't fucking make sense in my head. But like, I don't know. He saw Gloria, his wife, holding their baby boy, Malcolm, with tears running down their face. The two had already been injected with the poison. And he held her. He sat and held Gloria, whispering over and over that he loved her. Not telling her that it would be okay because he knew it wouldn't, but just telling her that he loved her so that that would be the last thing she heard because he knew that she was dying. To him, he was in shock and nothing made sense anymore, but he said in his mind, one thought began to echo louder and louder as he held his wife, and it was, "You cannot die. You must live. You cannot die. You must live."
Hmm.
When the poison was finally distributed, only a handful of people managed to escape Jonestown alive. A few had bolted into the forest amongst the chaos, slipping past the armed guards and disappearing into the dense black jungle. One 76-year-old woman named Hyacinth. Okay, mm-hmm. I couldn't figure out how to say it. She survived by...
It's a flower.
Oh, I love that. She crawled under her bed and she stayed there. And she eventually even fucking fell asleep and didn't wake up till the next day. Can you imagine what she woke up to?
I'm so sorry.
Yeah. Inside the pavilion, the horror reached its peak. Stephen Jones's mother, Marceline, tried to resist. She fought, she screamed, and she did everything in her power to protect those babies, every single child. They had to literally restrain her until the last child was given the poison, and then they let go of her. After that, Marceline quietly walked forward, took a cup, and drank the poison for herself.
I tell you, the heart on that woman.
That broke me. That fucking broke me.
That's a mother.
She was literally held against her will as she was fighting to try to save these children from being poisoned.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Sunday morning at dawn, around 6 a.m., the Guyanese army arrived at Port Katuma airstrip. For the wounded and terrified survivors who had endured the ambush, it was the first moment of actual relief. Soldiers secured the strip, and for the first time in hours, they felt they might actually live. Like, we actually have a chance.
Mm-hmm.
Helicopters ferried them all out, flying them all back to Georgetown. There was a U.S. medevac plane at Georgetown waiting for them, and the wounded were lifted aboard to be rushed to safety and to get treatment. But not everyone left. Washington Post journalist Charles Cross, himself injured, refused to evacuate because for him, the story wasn't fucking finished and he needed fucking answers.
Commit to the cause, buddy.
He was like, I need to see Jonestown with my own eyes. Like, what the fuck is going on? Now, soon after, the U.S. Armed Forces deployed to Guyana to investigate. David Natterville, one of the soldiers, later said they didn't know what they were walking into. All they knew that was Jonestown, that with Jonestown, it was full of about 1,000 people and many of them were armed, and that Jim Jones's name was already infamous.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a cuckoo nuts bananas man. A journalist and a photographer were given rare permission to accompany the U.S. Armed Forces to go into Jonestown, to get on the helicopter and go in.
Yeah.
Charles Cross was one of them. As their helicopter cut through the jungle sky, Cross peered down. At first, what he saw looked strange and like brightly colored clothing just scattered across the ground. One of the military guys said it looked like confetti that had been spread across the field. But as the helicopter drew closer, the truth became very clear. It was not clothing. It was bodies. Hundreds upon hundreds of them laying face down in the dirt. Jonestown had become a mass graveyard. When the soldiers landed, the silence was suffocating. The scale of the deaths stunned them. Scattered nearby were bottles of cyanide and the cut open shell of like a 50-gallon drum. I have a picture of it. It's over on our Instagram. We have so many pictures. Go check it out. Some of them, there's more pictures out there if you want to Google it. Some of them I will not be posting. So just.
We don't recommend looking up the actual site of the bodies because it is readily available everywhere on the internet.
I will post one that you can't see anything and it literally does just look like confetti.
Oh, the really zoomed out one.
Yeah. Like you're not going to see anything, but there's more if you still choose. I don't recommend.
There are close-ups of bodies, even babies.
I didn't even look those up. I took my pictures straight from documentaries. I was like, don't. That's what I'm going to do. That's the safe bit.
I didn't even mean to find half the things I found. And I was like, nope.
Mm-hmm.
Nope.
So, like I said, it was mixed with that Kool-Aid powder and they had mixed it in that 50-gallon drum that they had cut the top off of.
Mm-hmm.
So if you've ever heard the phrase, don't drink the Kool-Aid,
this is where that comes from.
This is where that comes from. So Netterville, the army man or the military guy, and his team began counting the bodies. And they called back in to report that they had discovered 450 bodies. The voice on the other end of the radio was stunned and couldn't believe it, also trying to confirm, like, 450? They're like, yes, 450. And yet even that staggering number told only part of the story. It didn't account for over half of the population of Jonestown. At first, the soldiers assumed the rest had fled into the jungle. So partially, everyone's like, oh my gosh, over half these people could be in the jungle surviving and we just need to go find them. Like, that's like, wow, all these people escaped. Newsflash, that's not what happened. As word spread, the world's press descended on Guyana, hungry, desperate for answers, trying to comprehend what in the fuck was going on. Back in Jonestown, U.S. forces moved in again, sending 200 soldiers just to help with the recovery of the dead bodies, because the military that came in was only there to just like assess and like figure out what was going on. But they show up to like mass amounts of dead people. So they send in 200 soldiers to help recover these bodies and assess the situation even deeper. As they are going through and finding people and stuff, they end up finding Jim Jones laying down, kind of like hunched over behind his like main seat, like his throne or whatever. He didn't die from the poison.
No, he didn't.
He was shot in the fucking head because he could not go out like his followers were forced to go out. Why? Maybe because he's a fucking coward.
He doesn't like to suffer.
Yeah, and he couldn't be the one to do it. So he made another person shoot him in the head.
Because he didn't really believe in any cause because there wasn't a cause.
Uh-uh.
This isn't a revolutionary thing. This was, he created a cult surrounded by himself and his own ego.
Part of me is like, he wanted people to know that like he was so much better than his people that he had to be known as going out in a different way.
Yeah.
Like he was so separate and so above his people. I'm not taking that poison. You're going to shoot me.
In the head too. So it's just instant.
In the head. This is so sad. They ended up discovering so many bodies that still had the syringe with the needle in the back of their neck.
Yeah.
Meaning they were not wanting to take it. They were not wanting to die, but were fucking murdered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Not one of these children wanted to take it.
Mm-hmm.
So bare minimum, every single one of those children were murdered.
Chased and murdered.
Chased, held down. Taken syringes and squirted into their mouth, forcing them to drink this. People were held down and injected in the back of their neck because they can't get away because you are going to die. You are going to be a part of this revolutionary suicide, aka mass murder.
Mm-hmm.
As U.S. soldiers and Guyanese authorities began moving through Jonestown, the horror deepened. They discovered more and more bodies inside the cabins, slumped over beds, many, like we said, had the injection sites on their neck. And from the jungle, a few survivors actually slowly did begin to emerge, and 30 in total, including 6 children. One of them was a woman named Leslie Wagner Wilson. Months before, she had been desperate to leave Jonestown.
Mm-hmm.
The fear in Jonestown was constant, crushing, and she felt trapped. Jim warned them over and over, "You'll die before you ever leave here." But when Congressman Ryan showed up and arrived, Leslie seized the moment and she and 11 others slipped away into the trees using the chaos of Congressman Ryan just being there as their cover to escape.
Yep.
She tied her baby to her back with a sheet and climbed this hill. And the whole time she refused to look back. And the whole time she said she was waiting for a bullet to hit her in the back. She's like, "I don't know how nobody saw us leaving." No idea. And they walked 30 miles through the jungle to reach safety.
Oh my God.
Only later did she learn she had escaped on the very eve of the massacre of Jonestown.
Wow.
She had no idea that that was going to happen. And that did happen.
Yeah.
Until she was informed.
I'm so glad she got away.
Unfortunately, she had family that was still there.
Oh, no.
And so her first thought was just like, oh, I hope my family got out. Because they're thinking at this point, it's only 450 people.
Yeah.
Where's the rest of the people, right? Now, or in Georgetown, about 50 temple members remained at the headquarters that had not committed suicide. Among them was Jim's son, Stephen Jones. And he was shaken, he was ashamed, and he was terrified. He felt the world would condone him, and they did, because basically, you know, he's, even though he's just the son of Jim Jones, he's like the next, he's like directly connected to him. So if they can't blame Jim because Jim's dead, they're going to blame Stephen. And they did. But what they don't realize is not only had he found out that his whole family was dead, but he came back to the headquarters and found Sharon and Leanne and her children murdered and in that room. And they also didn't know that Stephen like fucking hated his dad. Like fucking hated him. He had adored his mother, Marceline.
Well, how could you not?
Exactly. She's so sweet. But Jim had humiliated both of them. He introduced Stephen to one of his mistresses, trying to force a relationship between the two.
Ugh.
And also turned around and told Marceline everything about like his mistresses.
Mm-hmm.
Being very cruel to her. And breaking her heart. And that was the moment that Stephen was like, it broke. And I saw my father as a fucking monster. And I hated him. And he fought constantly. He was constantly rebelling against Jim the whole time, even in Jonestown. And he would be regularly beaten in public in front of the members for Jim to try to just gain some kind of control over his son.
Stephen's a real one.
Yep. Authorities recovered the tape that recorded, like, in the pavilion, all of Jim's sermons, and it recorded Jim's final speech that was laced with paranoia, despair, manipulation, and the sounds of screams around him as people were dying.
Yeah.
After 48 hours, officials still believed nearly 500 people were missing. Survivors of People's Temple were asked to return to Jonestown to help identify the dead. Among them was John Cobb, who had been, or Cobb, who had been born to the, into the temple, but had been in Georgetown as part of the basketball team.
Mm-hmm.
As he walked through the bodies, he found family member after family member, mothers, his mother, sisters, his in-laws, 11 of his loved ones had perished. And he just kept getting sheets and like trying to cover his loved ones that he found.
Mm.
The stench was becoming overwhelming. In one sweep, they discovered 35 to 40 more bodies lying in their beds. Some parents had died curled around their children, holding them tightly, even in death.
Yeah.
The missing 500 or so were never actually missing. They were there. Their bodies were stacked beneath others, hidden under the weight of the dead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think these people, a lot of them literally held each other until they died. And that's why they died in piles.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a theory. It's not true. I don't know if it's true, but that's just my theory.
I think some of the like psychosis, manipulation, brainwashing in the final moments probably did kind of lift.
I think so too.
Maybe not for all, but.
Yeah. 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 So the death toll first at 450 rose to 780. Finally, the full scale emerged, and it was reported differently in two different things. So it was anywhere from 908 to 912 people died. Nearly 300 of those were children.
That's disgusting.
Only 80 people survived or escaped Jonestown.
Mm-hmm.
The survivors insisted, instead of being met with sympathy, were vilified in the media because the media be mediating. Many headlines suggested that they deserved it, that they had chosen their fate, that it was their fault. I think it was very much the like, well, you stayed. Why didn't you just fucking leave?
Yeah. There also wasn't an understanding of like how cults operated for the most part. And like the victims, like the aftermath of what they like, what they dealt with in the moment and then afterwards too. So mental health was not recognized.
It's 1974. It not be good for mental health down in those days.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the gunman that was on the small plane that was like the fake defector. Okay. His name was Larry Layton. I don't know why I didn't have that in my earlier notes. Sorry. His name was Larry Layton. And he did not die. He did survive. I don't know exactly how he was caught, but he did not. I don't know if he just like didn't kill himself or like, I'm not fucking sure. But he did serve 18 years in prison before being released in April of 2002. So that motherfucker out here walking around somewhere.
Hi, Larry.
Just saying. Unless he died. He could have been dead by now, but who knows? Yeah.
Bye, Larry.
Rest in distress. I'm just kidding. I don't know. Hope you're healed and not brainwashed anymore. Moving on. The journalist, Tim Ritterman, who was wounded at the airstrip, he went on to write a book called Raven. It is one of the most definitive books on the Jonestown story. Worth a read. We'll link it in the show notes. No, Lola and I have not read books on Jonestown, but I will have a couple that I end up linking. Vernon Gosney became a police officer. He was the man who escaped, but his son died in...
Left a son.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He became a police officer and he lives in Hawaii. Stephen Jones, he has eventually gotten married and he's raised three beautiful daughters of his own, forever trying to live apart from the shadows of his father. He regularly speaks about his experience or about cults and brainwashing and and things like that.
He's been really outspoken. It's easy to find content that Stephen has put out there. So yeah, we stand with you, Stephen.
Yes, he's a very good man. Jackie Spear, Ryan's young aide, who was shot multiple times at the airstrip, she barely survived, okay? Barely. But her life comes full circle, and this is the coolest thing. 30 years later, she was sworn into the U.S. House of Representatives in the very seat once held by Congressman Leo Ryan.
Shut up.
I know.
I just got fucking chills.
I know.
Are you kidding me?
No, I'm not joking. Not joking. For years, the world called Jonestown a mass suicide, but history has finally corrected itself. And today it is remembered for what it truly was, a mass murder.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone take a breath, because that is the story. That is the end. Happy 100!
Happy 100.
Hope that was... I don't know. That was a lot.
It just took us, you know, I'll be honest, you guys have been asking for this case since we started this podcast 2 years ago. And we knew with the like really big iconic cases, such as like Charles Manson and Jonestown, we knew that eventually we would cover it, but we knew that it would be so much. It would be so much. I wanted us to wait because I kind of wanted us to have more education on like,
yeah,
all the different, like the tinier cults that we've done and all the other religious leaders that we've learned about. I feel like we went into this a little more well-rounded in our knowledge of it.
Agreed. And there's certain cases we have on our list where we're like, I know that's going to be a lot of research. And so like some of these cases, like there's one that I have researched for months and I had to just take a break because it was insane and I still have it sitting there. But it's an important case. And so also with these bigger cases, like where it's more well known, we don't want to just give you guys the same shit, just a different podcast name.
The same,
you
know, rundown.
We want to bring the full story. We want to really understand it. We want to bring a somewhat of a different aspect. But also it's hard because like I know you knew this story.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like, it's hard to do an episode when it's like, we know the other one already knows it.
Or knows the same things that you know.
Yeah. We don't like avoid or refuse to cover those kinds of cases. We just try not to do them very often because then you don't get the real like reaction, I guess. But there's still stuff we did not know on each side.
Oh, yeah.
We learned so much.
And again, you could go watch a million documentaries on this. You could read all the books, hear the interviews with survivors, listen to the podcasts, and you still would constantly be learning new things about this whole thing about Jim Jones' life, the survivors' lives, the cult, like things that happened inside of it, around it, whatever. So
yeah,
it's like a forever learning journey, which is kind of cool. And if you know something about Jonestown that we didn't mention, please tell us because we would also like to know.
Let us know. I told Lola this, that I watched two different documentaries, and I also listened to an entire season of a podcast called American Scandal. Each season, they do a different thing. And one of their seasons, I think it was like season 44, they covered Jonestown. I listened to that entire series. And it's crazy because they all kind of present it. It's the same story, but in kind of slightly different perspectives or from different people's perspectives, and share a few different storylines in it. And I was able to learn something new with each and every thing I watched or listened to and researched. So it was like, there really is. It's very vast and it's crazy. And that's the thing. That's the wild like spectrum when it comes to our cases, because our next case, it was so fucking hard the next case I'm covering, it was so hard to find really like any concrete stuff on this case. And I literally could only like find one person who told the story from like beginning to end, but with no like actual
like documentation.
But there is, I was able to find some documentation to back up what they said. But it's like, I was just like, this is insane. So it's kind of, it's an interesting story. But I'm like, it's crazy how wild the spectrum is. Like here we're drowning in resources. And then that one, I'm like,
and information. Others were like scraping our nails against the,
I'm scraping the bottom of the barrel, baby. And I'm like coming up with shit. So yeah. Anyways.
Well, tell us what you guys think about this. And happy 100th. Thank you for being here for this. Thank you for our Patreon community. Yes. You help support this podcast. You make this possible for us to continue to keep creating content. And if you want to join our Patreon community and get access to the Potty Podcast, which is exclusive bonus content, it's in the show notes, right?
Yeah, it's in the show notes. Yeah. And again, just a small little reminder, you got part one of Jonestown yesterday. You got part two of Jonestown today. You will not have an episode next week. The week after that is going to be our dark week. It is Thanksgiving. We will not have an episode. We are not going to do that to our editor and make him be editing on the week of Thanksgiving. So what we are going...
We're on stolen land. Anyway.
Anyways, it's true. I didn't mean to say anyways. I meant to say amen. But
yeah,
we are going to give you an episode called The Potty Podcast. So you're going to get a free episode that week.
Get a taste for it.
Over as a bonus episode. You get a little teaser, a little taste test to see if you want to go over to the Patreon and actually support us monetarily, but also getting content at the same time. And then in December, you're going to get two episodes in December. Okay. But they're going to come out one week after the other. Okay. So Thanksgiving week, you won't have an episode the next week. And then the 2 weeks after that, you'll have an episode, one each that week, those weeks. And then not until the first of the year. Hope that made sense. If not, we've been recording for 4 hours. My brain hurts.
It's fine. You talked about it at the beginning.
I did. We're good. That in the beginning of part one. I'm covering it again at the end of part two. Hopefully you guys are caught up and you're good to go. I love you guys. I'm not doing palate cleansers.
I was going to say, and that's all because we're not doing palate cleansers.
We're fucking dead.
Happy 100th. We're so grateful for you. With that, please stay safe, stay skeptical,
and
steer clear of the cultish carousel.
Please.
Bye-bye.